Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is called Matot. It means tribes. It's Numbers chapter 30, verse 1 to chapter 32, verse 42. The Haftarah is Jeremiah 1 to Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 3. And the Brit Hadashah is Matthew chapter 5, 33 to 37. Let's say a word of prayer before we get started. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu melech haolam. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, creator of all things. We thank you and praise you for your word and for all the things that you show us, and especially here at the end of days. Be preparing your people, Abba, to go in and take the land, just as you are preparing these people here in the Torah portion to go and take your land. Please bless us on this Shabbat, and may my words fall to the ground and yours come back fruitful. I pray in the name of Yeshua. Amen. What we have here in Matot is a legal structure that the Lord is giving to bring order to the nation of Israel, as the children of Israel are now getting ready to take their place in Israel. He has started to give them renewed instructions. He's renewing the covenant with them, and he's giving them a legal structure here in Matot. I'm going to show you that in just a little bit. Also, this Torah portion teaches us the importance of our words, the importance of the things that we say. And also, it teaches us here that because words are so important, that whatever Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh speaks, these are the things that he has to fulfill. And so we're going to take a look at that, and I'll show you why I say these things. Let's go to Numbers chapter 30 and start at verse 1. And Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes concerning the children of Israel, saying, "This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. If a man vow a vow to the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth." You know, this is right here where we learn that the Lord is going to fulfill his word. You see, if we go to the Haftarah in Jeremiah chapter 1 and look at verses 11 and 12, we will see that the Lord has actually said that. "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Jeremiah, what see you? And I said, I see a rod of an almond tree. Then said the Lord to me, You have seen well, for I will hasten my word to perform it." So, you see, this Torah portion teaches us that we need to be just like the Lord, and because he keeps his word, we need to keep our word. So there we have what I said earlier, that I was going to show you that the Lord teaches us that he is going to do whatever he speaks, he's going to fulfill that, and it's taught to us right here in Matot. Now back to Numbers chapter 30 at verse 3. "If a woman also vow a vow to the Lord and bind herself by a bond, being in her father's house in her youth, and her father hear her vow and her bond wherewith she has bound her soul, and her father shall hold his peace at her, then her vows shall stand, and every bond wherewith she has bound her soul shall stand. But if her father disallow her in that day that he hears not any of her vows or of her bonds wherewith she has bound her soul shall stand, and the Lord shall forgive her because her father disallowed her. And if she had a husband, then when she vowed or uttered aught out of her lips wherewith she bound her soul, and her husband heard it and held his peace at her in the day that he heard it, then her vows shall stand, and her bonds wherewith she bound her soul shall stand. But if her husband disavowed her on the day that he heard it, then he shall make a vow which she vowed, and that which she uttered with her lips, wherewith she bound her soul, of none effect, and the Lord shall forgive her. But every vow of a widow and of her that is divorced, wherewith they have bound their souls, shall stand against her. So we see here that the Lord has created a structure whereby the nation of Israel is going to get its legal structure from. And why do I say that this is the legal structure? You know, I've been saying, and Rico says, and, you know, some of us who understand that the scriptures are the legal context for the nation of Israel, understand that, you know, there's a with a preamble and all of that. But, you know, what's going on here in Matot is that there's a spiritual structure that underlies the legal structure that we get from the Constitution, which is the laws of the Torah. And so I'm going to show that to you in Matthew 5:33. He says, again, you have heard that it's been said by them of old time, you shall not forswear yourself, but shall perform to the Lord your oath. In other words, don't try to get out of the things that you've said that you're going to do. Okay, whatever you've told the Lord, that's what you need to do. And so, he further says, but I say to you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. For whatsoever more than these comes of evil. Well, what he's trying to tell us here is the importance of what we say. And not only of what we say, but of what we swear to do before the Lord and before others. And that leads me into the understanding of what is a vow and what is an oath. Because here in Matot, we're taught the difference between a vow and an oath. In Matot, we find these two words, which are neder, and that's vow, and shbuah, which is oath. So what is a vow and what is an oath? Well, the vow is something that you voluntarily agree to do before the Lord. It's your voluntary arrangement that you make before the Lord. It's between you and God. An oath is a voluntary arrangement between you and other people. Now, we have sometimes things that happen that are both vows and oaths, and the best example of that is, of course, our wedding vows. We call them wedding vows, but what they are a voluntary arrangement by the couple, between the couple and the Lord, that's a vow, and an oath between the two of them. So you see, you can have the vertical arrangement and the horizontal arrangement. So now I want to talk more about this vertical arrangement and the horizontal arrangement. And I have uploaded to my website a little PowerPoint. It's only like 10 frames long, but I want to show you some things because I don't want to ever be taken, my words have to be taken out of context. Let's go to frame number 3. And it says roles, and then you see there are two columns where there's rank. One of the things that this Torah portion teaches us in Matot is about the rank, the chain of command. Now, we know, according to the ancient Near East context that the Bible was written in, that there is something called a suzerain, and the suzerain is actually a word for sovereign. Suzerain means sovereign. The sovereign is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the king and father. But now there is another person down in the underneath the sovereign, who is the vassal, the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh vassal. His name is Yeshua. He is the prince, some places in Scripture, and he is also known as the son. He is the son of the king and the father, but he is the vassal. And then underneath that, you have the bride, which is Israel. In Scripture, she's called many things, bond servant, priest, woman, so forth. I didn't put woman on this frame here, but you get the point. Now, Matot teaches us specifically about the chain of command in the household. Israel, the commonwealth of Israel, the nation, is the Lord's household. And so now we're going to be able to see the connection and the comparison between the Lord's household and how things are arranged, and how things are arranged in the human household, with Messiah as being the sovereign of the household. The husband is then next on the list. He is the vassal to the Messiah. And then the wife is, you could say, the bond servant or the priest of, and I know that kind of goes against what, you know, we think that all priests have to be male. Well, there is truth in that. But the wife in this instance becomes the priest of the household. If she is, compared to the bride of Israel, which is called bondservants and priests, then the wife in the household is the priest of that household. But, you know, the husband is the high priest. Just like the vassal Yehovah is the high priest over the bride of Israel, the husband becomes the high priest, and the wife becomes a priest in that household. And so we start to see the structure of the human household and the nation of Israel as a household being very much the same. Now, if you'll go to frame number 4, you will see that not only is there a vertical relationship, but there's also a horizontal relationship going on here. And I call it status, because if your vertical relationship is correct, then you will get the horizontal status correct. Now, in this status, I'm going to show you the scriptures that bear this up. In this status, the sovereign Yehovah, king and father, is on equal status with the vassal Yehovah, prince and son. The same applies to Yeshua and the bride, and to the husband and wife. So now if you will go to frame number 5, you will see that I have put a scripture in there showing you the status, the horizontal status of the vassal to the sovereign. In Mark 16:19 it says, "So then after the Lord had spoken to them, he was received up into the heaven and sat on the right hand of God." And Philippians 2:6, "Who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God." So here we see that there is this association of the equal status of the vassal with the sovereign. And we understand that he gets that because, going back to frame number 3, that's what the sovereign and the vassal relationship is. You know, we understand this relationship also from the Torah portion of Joseph, where the sovereign, who is the Pharaoh, gives Joseph all authority. Joseph reigns just as if he is the sovereign, because he's on equal status with the sovereign. This is something that the sovereign can be, you know, can give. He can bestow upon a vassal this equality, you see. And so the sovereign there, the Pharaoh, bestowed on Joseph the equality to govern in Egypt, and there was no one higher in Egypt than Joseph except the Pharaoh. What that means is that Joseph gets his commands from the Pharaoh, just as Yeshua, Jehovah, gets his commands from the sovereign Jehovah, you see? And so, going back to number five, then, we can see how the commentators in the New Testament have brought this out, you know, to help us understand how Yeshua can be equal with the Lord, yet he is the vassal. And this is the structuring and the ranking and the chain of command that is given in Matot, and it's also given to us in the story of Joseph, as I just said. Now, if you will go to frame number six, you will see here that I have some scriptures regarding the equality of Yeshua and his bride. Their status of the bride will be equal with Yeshua, just like Joseph was equal with the Pharaoh, just like Yeshua is equal with the Father. And we'll also see at the bottom of that frame there where the wife should have the status of being equal with the husband. And, you know, the truth is that I'll tell you, when I was in land title, I've been a real estate agent, I've done mortgages, and I've done land title. I know a lot about contract law when it comes to land, which actually helps me in understanding the law concerning the land of Israel. But in the law, in most states, one person of a couple can purchase land, but when it comes to selling it, you have to have both signatures. Why? Because even in the secular world, wives are on equal status with their husband, you see. But that comes from a Bible principle. It's a biblical principle that says, and it's right here in Matot, that the status of the wife is on equal par with the husband, even though she gets her commands from the chain of command going up and down that vertical line. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 2, it says, "You know that the saints will rule the world, don't you? And if the world is going to be ruled by you, can't you handle insignificant cases?" And in verse 3, "You know that we will rule angels, not to mention things in this life, don't you?" So in Corinthians here, Paul is telling us that the bride is going to rule with her husband, Yeshua. In fact, in the book of Revelations, chapter 1, verse 6, it says that the Lord has made us kings and priests to God and His Father. Okay? Yeshua has made us kings and priests to God and His Father. To Him be glory and dominion forever and ever. And in Revelation 5, chapter 10, it says, "And has made us unto our God kings and priests, since we shall reign on the earth." As a matter of fact, in last week's Torah portion, I explained that the proper structure of the kingdom of Israel was that there would be the king, Jehovah, and then there would be the priesthood, and then there would be the people. It's the same exact structure. The priesthood reigns on the earth as the wife of the vassal, Yeshua, who is the king, who gave the laws, and who is the one that is coming to be king over us once again. So you see, this is not a violation of scriptural understanding at all that, would put the bride on the same status with Yeshua during the millennial reign, but it also puts the wife on the same status as her husband in the household. Yet, in Matot, we learn that there is a structure, there is a ranking, a chain of command that we need to follow. Now, why do we need to follow that? Well, for one thing, you know, I've heard people say, well, it's because women can make bad decisions. No. Let's not go to that. Let's not say that women can make bad decisions, because I've seen a lot of women make good decisions and a lot of men make bad decisions. So let's not play that, okay? But let's look at it from what the reality of it is. It's about the role. Now, I know that there are some women in the world who just don't like this thing about roles. Well, and they don't like being a female, because then they have to you know, live up to this role if they're going to be obedient to the Torah. Well, I didn't make the rules, and I didn't make you a woman. But I do know this, that when you make a vow, it affects what you do in that family. It can affect your family responsibilities. But now, what about a man? Doesn't his vows affect the family responsibilities? Well, actually, not as much. Men are freer to be away from the family, to do the things that they are able to speak with their mouth, than a woman is, because she is directly responsible for the family in a more intimate and nurturing way than the man is. Now, I'm not saying men aren't, nor that they shouldn't be directly involved in their families. That's not what I'm saying. But a man's vows speaks not only across his family, it also speaks across the community in a way that a woman's vows do not. Her vows are going to affect the family. His vows are going to affect the community. And by the way, the Proverbs 31 woman, while her husband is sitting in the gate doing his duty with the community, she's running the family. You see? So let's just back up and take a look at this and not say that women have less ability to make decisions, because obviously a woman can make such important decisions for her family that if she makes a vow and it interferes with her decisions for her family, something huge has been lost. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's not that she's less than or underneath or to be, you know, treated like a slave and made to be, you know, hand and foot with the husband. No, that's not her purpose. Her purpose is not to slave over him. Her purpose is to slave and serve the household. In fact, the Proverbs 31 woman does just that. The Proverbs 31 woman gets up in the middle of the night and starts working so that she can serve her servants. So that's why the woman's vow, the wife's vow, has to be overseen by the husband. He has to be able to make the decision about whether the loss of her household oversight is going to be a big hindrance to that household, because his job is actually to be out representing that household in the community. Her job is to be representing him in the household. You see how that all kind of fits together? He goes out, he represents the household in the community. She's in the household, she represents him in the household. By the way, we are the bride. We are supposed to be representing Yeshua as the bride amongst ourselves, amongst our community. And not only, you know, here in our community, but we are also the light to the world. I'm not diminishing that at all. Because I'll tell you what, if you're representing yourself correctly in your own household, you will be a bright, shining light to the world. Now, I know that things don't work out in human relationships the way that they should. And by the way, it's a travesty that in the Hebrew Roots community, we don't have marriages that fit this model. And I'll tell you why. Because there are women in the Hebrew Roots community whose husbands are abusing them. Now, what is a woman to do? We have heard it said in the past that women, if they have a problem with their husbands, why, you know, they shouldn't go to the elder, or they shouldn't go to the pastor, or, you know, they really shouldn't go anywhere but to the Lord to get their problem solved. Well, let me tell you what the problem with that is. The problem with that is that she is that man's sister. You know, the Song of Solomon talks about that kind of relationship too. He's not talking about incest there in the Book of Solomon. What he's talking about is she has a relationship with the Lord, and I have a relationship with the Lord, and before the Lord, we are husband and wife, but we are also brother and sister. That's what he's talking about there in the Song of Solomon. And because she's your sister, and she has a problem with you, it's up to you, oh husband, to say, you know, there's a problem between us. We need to get this straightened out. But most men won't do that. And so the woman is left frustrated and in tears because he will not give her her rightful place in the home as and on an equal status to him, with him being the authority and him her being the power to carry it out. You see, he won't let her be the proper Ezer Kenegdo. And by the way, he's shooting himself in the foot doing that, taking not only his authority, but taking her power. That's for another message altogether. But what is she to do? Well, my recommendation is that you handle it exactly the same way that the Lord said that we're to handle problems between brethren, which is, if he won't talk with you about it, then go to someone you trust. Ask them to talk to him and say, will you have a three-way conversation here? And I want to caution you women, because when there is a problem between the brethren and one of them has tried to work it out and the other, and party B, they won't work it out, so party A then has another recourse, which is to go get a third party involved. But party A needs to not go to party C and start yapping and talking about what's going on between the party A and party B. Because what that party A now has done is has put party C in the capacity of a judge. Judges render themselves unable to make judgments and to sit in court cases. They have to recuse themselves because they might know some of the circumstances of a case, and they then have some kind of vested interest. They have a preconditioned opinion, and they are not allowed to sit over a case that they have personal knowledge of. Well, when you, party A, go to get party C to help you with party B, you need to just say to party C, I've got a problem with party B, and I would like for your help. And leave it at that. Now, party C needs to go to party B and say, party A has said that there's a problem between you and him or her. And what we would like to do is actually sit down and talk about it. Now, party B is already going to be thinking, oh, sure, party A has already gossiped and, you know, torn me down and said all kinds of things about me that may be true or may not be true, and I wasn't there to defend myself. And so what party C, in his wisdom or her wisdom, needs to do is to say, by the way, party A has not told me anything about the trouble that's between you. That will all come out when we sit down with the three of us. Right away, it's been disarmed. You see, and party B then will be more likely to go ahead and sit down with party C and party A. Now, I hope you followed all the parties A, B, and C, and the point that I'm trying to make here. Women need to have a recourse with their husbands, who is also their brother in the Lord, just as brethren sisters and brothers need to have a recourse with other brothers and sisters, you see? So this is a wise way to handle it. Now, when we get to this other, I'm going to take you back to frame 7 of the PowerPoint, and we're going to review this, because there's a manifestation according to these vertical roles, you know, with the sovereign, the vassal, and the bride. The manifestation of that is according to what Paul has said and what the New Testament commentators have said, is that the, you know, Yeshua does the will of his father, and the husband is to do the will of Yeshua, and then the wife, of course, would do the will of the husband. Now, I don't want to get anybody confused and have them be thinking that I believe the wife has her relationship with the Messiah through the husband. That's not the case. It's she is this husband's sister. She has her own relationship. She doesn't have to go through her husband to get to the Messiah. But what I'm talking about here is household commands, household things, you know, that husbands and wives have to deal with, and also Torah commands. So, just like Yeshua does the will of the Father, the husband does the will of Yeshua, and the wife does the will of the husband, and that's the proper chain of command. And so, in John 5:30, here in frame number 9, I've made a comment up at the top. It says, everyone up and down the chain of command ultimately fulfills the commands of Yehovah. And that's really what the ultimate goal of this vertical chain of command is all about, is to get the fulfillment of the commandments of the Lord going. You see, John 5:30 said, the Lord is speaking here, Yeshua. He says, I can of mine own self do nothing. As I hear, I judge. And my judgment is just, because I seek not my own will, but the will of the Father which sent me. Which, by the way, husbands would do well to learn not to seek their own will, but the will of Yeshua. And the wives, when they see that the husband is seeking not their will, but the will of Yeshua, and then they bring that information back in love, the wife now is going to be loving and respectful of the husband. And as a matter of fact, if we will go to slide number 10, I will show you those scriptures from the commentaries that is the New Testament. Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives as Yeshua, Messiah, loved his assembly, his nation of Israel, and gave himself for it. See, that's the kind of love that husbands need toward their wives. And it says, husbands, love your wives and be not bitter against them, in Colossians 3:19. You know, husbands, the hardest thing to do is to not be bitter against a wife who is intransigent. Now, you know, I'm not here to say that all women are going to act according to their proper spot either, because women do get out of line. Men get out of line, women get out of line. But you're not to be bitter against them. You know, the Lord will take it up with them if you pray, but you also have recourse. You have the same, as party A, you have the same recourse if this wife won't come and do what's necessary with, you know, a third party to work out something after you have tried to work it out with her. If she won't do it, you have the recourse of doing exactly what I said earlier. Go get party C. But just say to party C, I need your help. We would like to have a meeting, and Let's get together, the three of us, and talk, and I will wait until we have the meeting to give you the details of the problem, you know, and just treat it the same way. The wife will then see that you're not trying to pound her into the ground. You see what I'm saying? And now, in Ephesians 5:33, it says, "For the women, nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence or respect her husband." By the way, reverence, respect, those are things that the bride of Yeshua owes to Yeshua. You see, I mean, again, we see the parallels between the vertical and the horizontal structure of the kingdom that is actually the spiritual underpinning of the commandments of the laws and the constitutional structure of the legal document that we call the Bible. So I hope that this portion here of the Torah portion has helped you to understand a little bit more about the structure of the kingdom, which the structure of our human relationships, especially in marriage, are supposed to reflect the structure of the kingdom that's coming. And so let's just move on and go to chapter 31 now. "And the Lord spake to Moses, saying, Avenge the children of Israel of the Midianites. Afterward you shall be gathered to your people." Well, the Lord is, you know, telling Moses ahead of time, prepare, because I'm going to take you. I have asked the Lord, I would like to know when I'm going to be taken. Now, I don't know if he'll ever tell me, and hopefully I won't be taken in this manner. Hopefully he will let me be, you know, alive and kicking when the resurrection happens, so that I can be among that group that Paul says is, you know, the rest of the people after the resurrection. I don't want to be resurrected. I want to be alive and well, but that remains to be seen. "And Moses spoke to the people, saying, Arm some of yourselves to the war, and let them go against the Midianites, and avenge the Lord of Midian. And of every tribe 1,000 throughout all the tribes of Israel shall you send to the war." So they sent 12,000 men to war. Eleazar the priest went ahead of them. And they slew all the Midianite males. And they slew the kings of Midian. And by the way, they also slew Balaam. So what is going on here in this chapter? Well, this is an object lesson for this generation of people who were not, most of them were not around when their fathers fought the Amalekites. So, you know, the Lord is giving them an object lesson. Yes, it is possible for you to go to war with me at the head, you know, Eleazar the priest going out in front representing me, and you can go to war, and you can have a battle, and you can win. You know, it's important for these people to understand that they are able to win wars, because we don't want to have a recurrence of the 10 spies, do we? We don't want to have them going, well, we can't go in and take that land because, you know, those people in there are stronger than us. So the Lord is giving them an object lesson to teach them that they can do battle and win because they have him on their side. And we know from Joshua, while, you know, that book is just full of wars, of, you know, the things they had to do in order to take the land and hang on to it, they need to know that they are capable. So this is their object lesson. And I think we're going to probably face something similar to that, you know, in the Great Tribulation. At the end of the Great Tribulation, or just before we go in to take the land, you know, perhaps we'll face a battle that the Lord is going to need us to face in order for us to understand that, yes, as his fighting force during the millennium, we will need to know that we can do battle and win, you see. Now, one of the things that they did was they made a huge mistake. And they brought back, they slew all the males, you see, but they didn't slay the women that had caused the problem in the first place. And so we had to clear that up. It would have seemed like common sense, but there they are. They're coming back with the spoil, and among the spoil is the women and the boys. And so down here in verse 17, he says, kill every male among the little ones and every woman that has known man by lying with him. But all the women children that have not known a man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. And then later on down in the chapter, we find that, you know, they're able to also keep the livestock, and they, you know, separate it, half for the children of Israel and half for the Levites. And so they're able to keep their spoil that way. Now we go to chapter 32. And we find out that we do kind of run up against that thing that we had there with the 10 spies. Only this time it's only two of them. It's Reuben and Gad. And they don't want to go across the Jordan. They have a lot of cattle. They're very well-off people, and they need a lot of space for their cattle. And so they want to stay where it's better for their cattle than where it's better for the children of Israel. And, of course, Moses gets a little bit testy with them in verse 6, and he says to the children of Gad and the children of Reuben, shall your brethren go to war, and shall you sit here? And wherefore discourage you the heart of the children of Israel from going over to the land which the Lord has given them? Thus did your fathers when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. So, you know, we're kind of having a little bit of this where they don't want to go, but it's actually for a different reason than that. But, you know, Moses is shaming them a little bit because they don't want to go and take the land of their inheritance, you see. And so they reach a deal, and it's, you know, decided that Reuben and Gad will fight with the children of Israel whenever it's required. And Moses says in 32:20 that if you will do this thing, if you will go armed before the Lord to war, and will go all of you armed over the Jordan before the Lord until he has driven out his enemies from before him, and the land be subdued before the Lord, then afterward you shall return and be guiltless before the Lord and before Israel, and this land shall be your possession before the Lord. But if you will not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. So they have reached an agreement, and Reuben and Gad actually do go and fight with Israel. So we almost had the same mistake here, but turns out that we really didn't. And so everything is getting all set now for the children of Israel to continue their preparation to take the land. And these are good lessons for us as we are getting prepared to take the land as well. I think it may not be very long. I don't know how long. I don't know if it's a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5, 10, 15, 20, or 50 years. But in this time scale of things, it's going to be very soon that the children of Israel are going to go and retake the land of their inheritance. And so it behooves us to understand not only the structure of the Torah and the laws and how they are the laws of the land, but also the scriptural underpinning and or the spiritual underpinning, I should say, of how the hierarchy is supposed to work and what our attitudes should be about taking the land. And if we go to battle, let's have a little bit of common sense about the spoil that we bring back, you see. So all of these things are lessons for us here at the end, just like Paul said that, you know, they're examples for that generation at the end of days. I hope this Torah portion has been a blessing to you.